enough for Republicans to wake up is... The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to. Do it live!
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Thanks for downloading the latest from peterbcollins.com. We've got a dispatch from the war zone of northern Iraq. Joe Lauria, who covers the United Nations as an independent journalist, is on the scene in Erbil, and he's got a lot of observations to share with us during this pivotal week as peace talks are underway around the Syrian war, that's in Geneva, and Vladimir Putin shocked the world on Monday, announcing that Russian forces are withdrawing from Syria. But Joe Lauria points out there hasn't been much of a withdrawal. It appears to be kind of a stand down, and it appears to be an effort to pressure the Assad government to engage in those peace talks in Geneva. There's a lot more, and you'll hear it from Joe Lauria in just a moment. But first, I always like to thank the people who support my work with your subscriptions to the Peter B. Collins podcast. People like Brian Massey, Andy Krieger, David Radcliffe, and I see Andy Krieger's name here again. He's got two subscriptions. Thanks to everybody who supports me, and I hope you'll join their ranks. Come on over to peterbcollins.com. You click the menu button, then you click Become a Subscriber, and you can choose $5, $10, $20 a month. New annual subscribers with a mailing address in the continental U.S. earn a bonus book, and I've got three titles for you to choose from now. Check the website for those details.
In a war zone! 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 In a war zone!
A little death metal from the Transplants to get us rocking into our podcast today as we connect up with correspondent Joe Lauria. He's an independent journalist who covers the United Nations and travels to war zones. And today he joins us from Erbil, Iraq. That is in the northern portion of Iraq. Joe Lauria, it's great to talk to you. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you, Peter. Very good to talk to you again.
And I always like to ask a talented journalist like you for a quick scene setter. Look out your window or wherever you happen to be there and describe what you see for my listeners, please.
It's a courtyard of a university dormitory where I'm staying, so it's not very exciting.
Okay.
Last time I spoke to you was, I believe, last time we were on the air together was July of 2014. I spoke to you from Ramallah and the West Bank, and we could hear the cry for prayer during the broadcast, but I'm sorry it's not as exciting here.
Okay.
And as it was that time, I was not in the war zone in Gaza, but near it, and likewise, I'm an hour away from Mosul, our drive, which is with Islamic State, is still occupied. So ISIS is very close, but this is extremely well defended here. This is where Obama first started attacking, bombing in his piecemeal way. The Islamic State is when they moved on this city where I am. Mm-hmm. They got within 10 minutes, someone told me. They almost took this city, and Obama started bombing. And since then, it's very well defended, and it's an extremely safe environment. So it's kind of misleading to say I'm in a war zone, very close to one, though, very close.
And describe daily life in Erbil, and what is the visible presence of American advisors or commandos in Erbil right now, Joe?
Well, I'll take that part first because it's interesting. You don't see them at all. They have, you know, during the invasion, afterward, there were American troops here. But the other day, maybe a week ago, a small passenger plane crashed not far from where I am, maybe a couple of kilometers away. And it was an American Army plane, but a civilian plane. And within minutes, there were American troops there and trucks. I have no idea where they came from. So obviously, there are bases around here. but you don't see them driving around in the streets. So it's not like that anymore. But they're here. There's no question about it.
And who controls the streets of Erbil? Is it Iraqi military and police officers?
It's a completely civilian place right now. There are a few police officers. You don't really see them the way you see them in the U.S., perhaps. Look, the situation here now is many people have lost their brothers and their fathers in this war because they're, again, fighting not far from here against Islamic State. But within this city, it's extremely peaceful and calm. The problem here is economic because the oil price crash has really devastated this region. This is the Kurdish region of Iraq, the only part of Iraq that benefited from the American invasion in 2003. And I have to say, speaking to many Kurds, and I'm generalizing here, they don't really seem to care all that much about the suffering that their Arab compatriots have suffered from the American invasion and the aftermath.
Mm-hmm.
And that's partly because there's years of animosity towards Arabs in this region, and particularly against Saddam Hussein, of course. He committed this genocidal act of chemical weapons in the city of Halabja, which I visited when I was here 2 years ago. And, they commemorate that every year. I went to a ceremony not too long ago. It's a huge event, obviously. Saddam was brutal. There's no question about it against the Kurds. The Kurds have been screwed by everybody, as everybody knows about the Kurds, by the Iranians, the Turks in particular, and the Syrians, although we may get into that. They're doing a lot better in Syria now.
Mm-hmm.
And so the place is calm, and the Arabs are not particularly liked. And that brings us to the main, and the relationship between Baghdad, the central government, and here is a disaster. They do not talk to one another at all. They're not paying any, they're not sharing oil revenue, whatever little they have now. They're selling it through Turkey. They have nothing to do with Baghdad. They're not paying any taxes. They're not receiving any aid from the central government. It's, for all intents and purposes, an independent country, but they're always on the verge of declaring independence. And interestingly enough, Israel and Israeli ministers have been are constantly calling for this place to become independent, which kind of fits into Israeli thinking about breaking up countries, Arab countries.
Mm-hmm.
But the issue is the oil money, and government workers have not been paid here in 7-8 months. It's really getting to be a crisis. And in Sulaimaniyah, which is the second largest city here, they have protests there, and I've been told that police have opened fire and killed people. So that doesn't happen for some reason here in Erbil. They're much more passive here.
Mm-hmm.
But that could start happening because, as we go on and on without people being paid, things are going to get tough here. So that's the situation we're in now. Now, Mosul is the second largest city in Iraq, and it's very close to here, as I said, about an hour drive. And it's a mixed Kurdish and Arabic city, and it's taken by the Islamic State, and they are controlling it. That is the focal point now of what's going to happen. Now, there was a battle west of Mosul about a week or so ago, and about 12 Islamic State guys were killed. The local press here reported pictures of their dead bodies in the paper. But they cannot coordinate. The Kurdish government here, run by Masoud Barzani, and there's a long history of that family ruling as a major tribe in this area, and the central government in Baghdad, they cannot get their act together to attack Mosul. The Americans are here. I think they opened up a new center a couple of weeks ago to try to coordinate this. The British defense secretary was here today in this city meeting. He went to Baghdad, and then he came here to meet Barzani. So I think something's moving here. The Americans and the Brits are trying to get these two forces together. But as the Kurdish journalists I met with told me, that neither one want to die for each other. The Kurdish soldiers don't want to die to help Arabs in that city, and Arab soldiers don't want to die to help the Kurds. There's a lot of mistrust there. And that's hurting the efforts of the West to bring these forces together to take back Mosul, which they've got to do to get it away from the Islamic State. And there's one other huge issue here. I'm on high ground, apparently, but that dam, the Mosul Dam,
right,
the Islamic State briefly took over, it just came an issue in the U.N. Security Council last week. Mm-hmm. This dam could go at any minute. It is in an awful condition, and they're doing terrible work to try to put concrete underneath there to shore it up. It could break at any minute. It would kill maybe up to 1 million people. It would just flood the Tigris River, and it would kill almost everybody in Mosul and all the way down to Tikrit. It could even reach Baghdad. So this is really another big issue here.
Now, Joe, what you've been describing strikes me as the de facto partitioning of Iraq. And with the desire of Iraqi Kurds to separate from Baghdad, with the desire of the Syrian Kurds who control that huge swath along the Turkish border in northern Syria, and they have just articulated their aspirations to make that a permanent Kurdish zone. The desire to form a Kurdish state, of course, raises huge hackles in Turkey, where they claim they're fighting Daesh, but they're actually suppressing, you know, the aspirations of their own indigenous Kurdish population. How do you see this playing out, and what markers are visible right now as to the potential for a Kurdish state, which, given the control of western Iraq by Daesh, would leave the Shiites in Baghdad with a shrunken state and a greater need for an alliance with Iran?
Yeah, that's true, but I think there's almost zero chance at this moment of a Kurdish state that you're describing. And it's not just the external forces in play, but, you know, how Iran and Turkey and Syria and the Iraqi government would react, but inside the Kurds themselves. There are not great relations between Barzani, who rules the Kurds here in northern Iraq, and the Syrian Kurds. The PYG is kind of related with the PKK, and they are in alliance, and they have good relations, the Turkish Kurds and the Syrian Kurds. But the Syrian Kurds and the Iraqi Kurds do not have good relations. Barzani has fought, actually, against PKK. He's kind of seen as a lapdog here to President Erdogan, this growingly authoritarian leader on the verge of becoming a dictator in Turkey, shutting down newspapers, etc., suspicious explosions killing people in Ankara and Istanbul,
followed immediately by bombing
of Kurds inside Iraq here, and mostly in Syria. He wants to crush this federal Syria that you just mentioned.
Joe, let me just add about Erdogan that he is successfully extorting membership in the EU and billions in payments at the expense of refugees who are being treated as chattel or as leverage.
Pure blackmail. It's absolutely unmitigated, horrendous behavior on Turkey's part to use these people who suffered so much, and who, I might add, Europeans are not treating very kindly either, for the most part, and to use them as pawns here to get up to $6 billion and a fast track to EU extension. So this is just, that's a horrendous side story. But what he's worried about is the Kurdish Syrian Kurds, who are fighting his people, who are the Islamic State. Let's be honest about it. There's plenty of evidence now that Turkey has helped the Islamic State, buying their oil, letting their troops, their soldiers and fighters come in to Iraq and weapons. And we have evidence from a newspaper, Cumhuriyet, in Turkey, that published a video on their line proving that this truck, that the police were involved, giving arms to Islamic State. And, of course, that editor was thrown in jail as a terrorist suspect by Erdogan. This is the way he deals with people now. So he's been lobbing shells and fighting inside Syria. And a couple of weeks ago, there was a town, Azaz, it's called, it's north of Aleppo, inside Syria. And the prime minister, Davutoglu, said that city will not fall. And they were going to keep shelling and trying to stop. Now, that city is very interestingly near the town where, the place where the Ottoman Empire was born. I mean, the first over outside of Turkey settlement that the Ottomans had, and that was very close to this town at Azaz, and that could be where Erdogan's neo-Ottoman dreams die. Because if he invaded, and this was the story about 4 weeks ago that I was writing about, and it's kind of died down, but with this Putin surprise announcement of withdrawing troops from Syria, that's more complex than meets the eye, could open up, and this is the last thing I wrote, he could open up this revival of an idea by the Turks and the Saudis to invade Syria. Now, both of them Why do they want to do that? Because they have seen what Russia's intervention has meant. 5 months of bombing by the Russian Air Force, the reconstitution of the Syrian Arab Army by the Russians, the introduction of more Shia militia from Iraq, Hezbollah, Iranian troops. They have made enormous gains. They had lost a lot of territory at Idlib. They have moved all the way to around and virtually have surrounded Aleppo. Mm-hmm. And they even got a Syrian army got close to Raqqa, which is the capital, so-called, of Islamic State.
Right.
These gains were enormous, and the Turks and the Syrians, who have invested everything in the last 5 months, 5 years, rather, to overthrow Assad, have seen this whole regime change project going up in smoke. They wanted to invade, but they threw the ball in Obama's court, hoping, I think, that Obama would not want to be seen as the president who lost Syria, the way we talked about losing China, and his legacy and all this vanity about legacies of presidents in the last year talk about. So they goaded him to invade because they wouldn't do it without a U.S. Lead, a U.S. ground force. He's resisted that. And if you can see in that Atlantic piece that came out last week, that long piece, mm-hmm. You know, he's resisted Kerry's entreaties to fire missiles secretly at Assad. So he stood up to the neocons, not in Ukraine, not in Libya, but he has in Syria. But guess what? There's an election coming up, and who knows who's going to be the next president. And we saw in the debate in the Republican Party last week where 3 out of 4, Kasich being the only one who didn't, and that was Rubio, Trump, and Cruz, all said they would back 20,000 to 30,000 American troops in Syria. So, and Sanders, I have to add, is naively, in my view, talking about Saudi Arabia getting more involved,
yeah,
and the Gulf countries to invade, to get involved, to defeat ISIS. The last thing you want is Saudi Arabia invading Syria, because they're interested in overthrowing Assad, supporting those extremists. And one reason could be to set up a partitioned eastern part of Syria, a kind of Sunni stand, it's being called. And the Turks don't want a federal Kurdish Syria. But this idea is to run maybe a pipeline from Qatar to Saudi Arabia through this part of Syria and through Turkey into Europe, which would undercut Russia, who sells to go to Europe, because Russia sells the majority of gas, of course, to the Europeans. That might be one reason why Russia intervened. But I also think, sincerely, they wanted to defeat these extremists who threaten Russia. And they went a long way, and then there was a surprise announcement of his withdrawal, which I think could open the door again to these ideas of invading, but probably not under Obama.
Now, let's talk about this surprise announcement from Putin that came this past Monday, Joe, because it shows a lot of things, and let me start with how it reflects on Putin. Number one is that he dodged the quagmire tag that Obama tried to put on him by showing that he is adept enough to get in and get out while the U.S. is still mired in. We pretend, you know, that we don't have huge numbers of ground forces there, but we're deeply involved with many of these alleged rebel groups, and we continue to focus on taking out Assad at the same time that we say that we're fighting the Islamic State. And so this pivot on Putin's part, was it mainly to brush back Assad and get him to take the current peace talks and the tenuous ceasefire seriously? Or was this much more related to Russia's more international posture and its duels with the United States, say, over Ukraine?
Victoria Nuland, who your listeners probably know, had a lot to do with the coup in Ukraine, would say that this had nothing to do with Ukraine. There's been no backroom deals. So let's assume that's true. On the quagmire issue, I don't think there was ever even a hint of a quagmire. That was just bluster from Obama. Mm-hmm. A quagmire is when you're in a long-term war and you're neither winning nor losing. And the Russians, from the very start, started to make gains and helped the Syrians to make the gains. They've been winning, which is why I think Turkey and Saudi wanted to invade. So there's no quagmire there. He got out. I think you're absolutely right about the Assad angle. I think he got out because he feels that the Russians and the Syrians and the other allies there have destroyed enough of Islamic State and al-Nusra Front and al-Shara al-Ram and Jaish al-Islam and these groups to allow for a compromise at the negotiations in Geneva. And Assad a few weeks back said he wanted to take all of Syria. And the Russians told him no. In fact, Vitaly Churkin, the UN ambassador from Russia, said publicly that there will be consequences for Assad if he tried to do that. So the Russians have said this is not possible. Mm-hmm. Yes, they want him to go to Geneva and come up with a deal. They have saved his, taken his nuts out of the fire, and he has survived and he thrived under them. And there's got to be some feeling in Damascus like, well, why are you leaving now? Because we were making such progress. Well, the answer is very muddy because we don't know how many planes are being withdrawn. Apparently only maybe 10. There have been 50, about 50 Russian planes there. Just mm-hmm. relatively small operation that cost about $400 million in 5 months. Not a hell of a lot of money in a military sense. And so that wasn't an issue about whether it was costing Russia too much. But he does want Assad to come to the table and make a deal. And he's throwing the ball in Obama's court and basically say, why don't you fight Islamic State now? Why don't you take Raqqa, they said last week, Lavrov, the foreign minister, mm-hmm. which was a funny thing. But now I'm beginning to understand why they said that. And today Putin added, this is a very fast-moving story. Today Putin added that within 24 hours they can get all those, whatever they've withdrawn, they can get back again. A, it's not a large number, and B, it's not that far. So if, let's say, there was some movement again to threaten the territory that was won, or, God forbid, the Turks and the Saudis try to invade, he'll get back in there, which could cause, if the U.S. is involved, you know, a conflict between the U.S. and Russia looked somewhat possible a few weeks ago when all this was heating up, which obviously is one of the most dangerous things we could be talking about.
Let me clarify that, because I'm thinking of the language that's been used in the Iranian nuclear talks, and that if Iran, you know, crosses a line or is found to have been violating the agreement, that we can snap back the sanctions into place almost as fast as you can snap your fingers. And it's fair to say that what Russia has announced is more of a stand down or a temporary halt in activity as opposed to an actual withdrawal. And this allows them to continue to support Assad without running daily air raids, and it allows some breathing space, but they're still on duty there, on call, essentially. And if the U.S. makes moves to threaten the Assad government or other things that draw a negative reaction from Moscow, then Russia is in a position to resume hostilities almost immediately. They can snap back to a military posture.
But there's a difference between being in the air and dominating the skies of Syria, which Russia's been doing, as a deterrent, to coming back in again after the U.S. does something or the Saudis or the Turks do something. Then you've opened up the door. This is my feeling, that it's a risk. There's a big risk there that the no-fly zone, which Erdogan has been screaming about for 5 years, which Hillary Clinton was screaming about when she was Secretary of State, this, if Russia is no longer dominating the skies, this might come back again as a realistic possibility. And that would bring the U.S. into the war in a deeper way, because you have to have people on the ground. You've got to fight, shoot down anti-aircraft on the ground, kill Syrian soldiers. You're in a war when you're doing no-fly zones, not just about what's flying. So Putin, again, we don't really know how many he's withdrawn. Could this be a lot of optics here? And he did on the day that the Geneva talks began again last Monday. That was no coincidence. So he also, there's the cessation of hostilities, which has held. It only involves a small number of groups that have signed up for this ceasefire, something like 50 out of 1,500 or 100 out of 1,500. So, but there has been a definite decline in violence compared to what we've seen. So there was maybe less reason for Russia to be involved. But today there was a report that they struck some Islamic State sites near Palmyra. And I don't know whether this is true or not, but there's an American official with quarters saying it didn't happen. It's very difficult sometimes to know exactly who to believe here. It's war.
Yeah.
But they, by leaving, I think they're risking opening up a bad situation where it may be hard to get back in the same way. And then, but again, they're keeping those bases and this very important S-400 anti-missile defense, anti-aircraft defense, which is one of the most advanced, if not the most advanced anti-aircraft ever created. And it's got these massive... I was looking at a video of it. It's just horrific to watch it. And it's accompanied by rock music. It's kind of pornography. It's horrible to watch, actually. But this is a very effective missile defense that could shoot down the Turks or anybody who tries to get in there.
Now, Joe, you're there in Iraq, and you posted a dispatch on Monday, I think it was Monday or Tuesday, at consortiumnews.com, entitled Risks in Putin's Syria Withdrawal. And one of the questions that you raised was about the prospect of some sort of a grand bargain, that Putin and Obama agreed that Obama will soften the efforts to sanction Russia over Ukraine in exchange for this forbearance in Syria. And I want you to know that you have impact perhaps beyond what you imagine, because Josh Earnest in the White House press room on Tuesday afternoon denied that that there was such a deal, and they even moved to the obscurity of labeling this as from a senior administration official, said, quote, there was no strategic grand bargain between the United States and Russia on Syria. So I want you to know that your speculation drew a direct rejection from the White House and from this unnamed senior administration official.
As much as I'd love to believe you, I'm not the only one who was saying that that afternoon. Your good friend and often guest, Pepe Escobar, I wrote that as well on Facebook. And there are others. I mean, I didn't read everything that was being said. I don't think I was the only one saying that.
Oh, but come on, Joe.
They're reading Consortium News in the White House spokesman's office, I mean, that's great. They should be reading it. I don't know. But no, the issue is whether there's a grand bargain. As I said, Nuland said the next day, she denied this too on the record, so she may have been the off, you know, the administration unnamed source, but somebody went on. She went on the record and said no, and it doesn't seem to be any indication of that. And we don't know how much the Americans knew in advance. Apparently, there was a phone call, I think maybe to the White House, telling them, but only hours before. It seems like nobody in the State Department seemed to know about it.
Right?
Maybe Kerry did, but. Look, it's a dramatic move on his part. It's worked for him domestically because these pilots arrived back and there was marching bands and they threw the pilots in the air at the airport. So it's like a big victory. And he did what he was going to say. He didn't get involved too deeply into this war. But the risks are there. But he's doing it, I think, as you say, for the diplomatic opening that he's trying to get in Geneva. Now, if I could talk about Geneva for a second.
Yeah, please.
They've already hit a roadblock. And the big roadblock was what you mentioned at the very start of this conversation, the Syrian Kurds calling for a federal state. Now, previously, Russia had said that they thought that was a good idea and they would support that if the Syrians want it. And Assad himself said that if the Syrian people want a federal state, and they do, he would have a referendum, and they could vote for it, and he would accept it, and they would change the constitution to reflect that. And of course, a federal state means the central government still has control. The United States is a federal system, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, but they would have devolved powers like American states have. And yet today in Geneva, the Bashar al-Jafri, who's the UN ambassador for Syria, who I know from New York, he's the chief negotiator for the Syrian government in Geneva, and he said, no way we'll accept federal status for the Syrian Kurds. But so that's a big problem. Maybe the timing was wrong for the Kurds to say this. But the bigger problem is the guy who's leading the opposition negotiation, a guy called Mohammed Alush, and he is the head of this Jaish al-Islam, the Army of Islam, which was a Saudi cobbled together coalition of 100 or more extremist groups, a group that actually put people in cages in the suburbs of Damascus as human shields, live people, to protect them from attacks by the Syrian government. And this is from that observatory, Syrian Human Observatory, whatever that guy's name is. There's one guy in London, and he's the one who said this. So Jaffrey said, the Syrian negotiator, that he will not talk to him. So there's not going to be, at any point, if that guy continues to lead the negotiation, this Saudi-led opposition group, they will not be direct to go. That's a real problem, too. And the other problem was that Assad, that the foreign minister, Mullah, said when the talks began Monday that it's a red line for Syria to talk about the presidency.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the Geneva communique that this is based on, this is the plan, that they would negotiate, and when they get a deal, they would create a transitional government, a unity government, at which time Assad steps aside. He may have a role, but he won't be the president. And that lasts for 1 year when they write a new constitution and they have a new election. And then maybe Assad could run again. Kerry and Americans have said they weren't objecting to that. That upset the neocons and liberal interventionists in Washington. But so now, you know, the Syrians are saying he won't go at all. And he has to go after this deal is made, if it's made, for a year. He can come back again. So it may be. So that's another big stumbling block. So this thing is very fluid and very dangerous still. And Russia leaving, you know, what impact it's going to have is really fascinating because we're going to have to see.
Joe, I want to ask you about one other so-called American ally, the House of Saud. They, of course, have been very active in trying to take out Assad. And they have been, you know, using proxies, funding many of these arrayed rebel groups there against the Assad government. Now, they also opened up a front in Yemen. And this week, the Houthis apparently swapped some prisoners and made some overtures for some peace talks. The Saudis seem really hell-bent on their objectives in both Yemen and in Syria. How do you, you know, characterize their current role? And are there active efforts by the United States to get them to support the Geneva peace talks and to work toward a true ceasefire that will hold?
Yes, there are efforts by the United States because they're there in Geneva right now. This is the Saudi group that they put together. So Kerry is working on the Saudis and Lavrov on the Syrian government. It's a Russian-American sponsored talks, really. UN is brokering. So, but the Saudi, before I talk about Yemen, I have to say that just last week they had an unbelievable, it's being said to be the largest military exercise in the history of the Middle East. The report is up to 350,000 men, over, you know, hundreds of tanks and planes, took part in a military exercise in the desert, somewhere in Saudi Arabia, not far from Syria, that was sending a message that they're ready to invade if the Americans allow them to. And, you know, early on, the Saudis were sending supposedly planes to the Turkish Incirlik Air Base, which is only about 100 miles from the Syrian border.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a major thing. Now, in Yemen, we have to look at a personality here in the side of Saudi Arabia, because we have two very irrational, dangerous men involved here. That's Erdogan in Turkey and Mohammed bin Salman in Saudi Arabia. He is the son of the king, King Salman.
Right, he's the prince.
Mm-hmm. He's the deputy crown prince, so he's second in line after, forgetting his name now. And he is also the defense minister. And it's his war in Yemen. He has to win that war. His future is on the line. Saudi Arabia is hurting. The people are grumbling. The oil prices really hurt them. They've squandered lots on this war, and they have to win this war. And now they seem like they want to double down on Syria. So it's completely reckless, as Erdogan is reckless in wanting to invade to crush the Syrian Kurds because of their influence on the Turkish Kurds. And there's been a war going on in southern, southeastern Turkey as well, all this too. He crushed. It devastated one city there and killed lots of people. And that's, you know, in the shadows of what's going on in Syria. So the Saudis are really kind of in, you know, they're still talking a good game, but there's a lot of problems underneath there in their policy in Yemen. It's been an utter, absolute failure, disaster. They cannot, this is the richest Arab country in the region against the poorest, and they cannot defeat this Houthi alliance with President Saleh, the former president.
Right.
And it's of course, the people are always the ones who suffer, the common people. That's been the case in Yemen, certainly in Syria. So what's going on there is, you know, the Saudis want a deal. If they can get rid of Assad, they may go for a deal. Assad won't go right away. He may not go at all. So this is where we're at.
Yeah.
Geneva.
And Joe, finally, I'd like to ask you about the refugees. Millions of people have been displaced from Syria, And, of course, hundreds of thousands are still homeless in Iraq, where, you know, there are fairly frequent suicide bombings and other incidents. Do you think that we're really going to come to grips with this? Because Europe, as you pointed out, has turned hostile toward the plight of the refugees, and they're doing everything they can to just stem the flow by locking the borders along the way and by greasing Turkey to try to get them to set up more refugee camps. And Turkey and Jordan have taken the bulk of these Syrian exiles. This is a problem that is going to continue well after any hostilities are brought to an end.
Oh, there's no doubt about this. And, you know, the Europeans and the Americans have a lot to answer for why we are seeing this refugee crisis. A, Libya. Hillary Clinton's war. Absolutely unnecessary to overthrow Gaddafi. It has caused many, many Africans to flee because the weapons flood out of Libya into Mali and these other places, cause conflicts there, and they are fleeing. Number two, Syria. You know, the West and the Gulf countries, deeply involved in stirring up this, paying for it, and has caused many of these refugees. And Afghanistan, some of them are Afghanis. And then we have to look at the difference, and the American and Western media keeps confusing refugees and migrants. Refugees fleeing a war. A migrant is fleeing bad economic conditions. And even there, the Europeans and the West have played the role of undermining the economic well-being of Africans by exploiting the resources the way they did in colonial times in the same way. So, you know, and also there's kleptocracies amongst African leaders, and that's how neoliberalism works, relationship between foreign capital and local thugs who steal everybody's money. So these people are leaving for economic reasons. This is a problem that Europe and the United States has created, largely they've created, not completely. And to turn their backs on these people is just horrendous. Now, if the war ends, if it really ends, you know, a priority will be to get people to return. And that will be a very, very long process if indeed we come to the end of this horrific conflict.
And Joe, let me echo what you were alluding to about the United States because of Trump and all of this hysteria. You know, I believe we've taken less than 5,000 Syrians total. Into the United States in the last 5 years. And yet, in the last year alone, more than 43,000 Cubans were admitted to the United States, mostly coming in over the Mexican border at Laredo. And they, of course, enjoy special status under the Cuban law that we passed in 1966. And I just find it astounding that with all of this angst and hate speech about immigration, that nobody identifies this very special treatment of Cubans while we are blocking and pretending that we can keep out billions of Muslims from the United States.
Politicizing human lives. This is completely political to do that with the Cubans and to demonize Arabs and Muslims. And Trump is not the cause of this, but he's expressing it more than anyone. And it's horrendous that the U.S. has only taken 5,000 in. And this is a failure of leadership of the country to stand up for the values. And Obama's made a few speeches, but why are they taking more in? Why aren't they taking... This problem of Islamophobia, I'm sure you've done shows on it, and we could talk forever on this, is a hugely growing problem. People don't know anything about Islam. They don't understand. They don't even know Muslim people, and they are, and that ignorance and that bigotry is, you know, is dough in the hands of somebody like Trump.
Yeah.
You know, he's just play dough. So, that's Obama. He's already deported more than I think most administrations have done.
That's true.
Number one, and he's leaving and he's letting in Cubans because of this whatever Congress has come up with because of the Miami and getting Florida in a presidential election.
Right.
Has something to do with that too, I would imagine.
You are right on.
That's awful. Yeah.
Well, Joe, I want to thank you for excellent reporting and commentary from Erbil, Iraq today. And I also want to acknowledge that I really appreciate your activity on Facebook. We're friends, and You post frequently a lot of good information from sources that I'm, you know, not accessing on a regular basis. So I just want to put that out there and invite my listeners to become your friend on Facebook, too, because I've never seen you post a picture of your breakfast or a kitty cat. and I do appreciate the information and the perspectives that you share with us in social media.
Well, thank you, Peter. I'll have to deal with a lot of requests now for that, but I appreciate it. And it's a good place to put out small things, and you know, I don't have to work on a whole article. But one main reason is I don't have a cat, so that's one of the main reasons that you don't see that. Okay.
All right, Joe, you be safe, and we'll talk to you when you're back stateside.
Thank you, Peter. All the best.
Joe Lauria here on the Peter B. Collins Show. Thanks for listening to this dispatch from Iraq, featuring Joe Lauria. I'm Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.